the Civil Law Committee to order. Clerk will note the roll. A quorum is present. And members, let's get the minutes handled from 4-11-11. Any motion to approve the minutes? Representative Druskowski moves the approval of the 4-11 minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Motion to approve the 4-13-11 minutes.
Sucks.
Somebody? Draz? Looks like it's your day for the minutes. Representative Druskowski moves the approval of the 4-13-11 minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, a quick roadmap. Representative Woodard, if you want to come forward, we'll be bringing your bill up shortly. Representative Smith wasn't able to make it this morning, and so we're, as a courtesy, going to have still hear his bills. Representative Holberg has agreed to step in to present it, and Representative Scott or Druskowski will present his second one. We'll do Representative Woodard's first, Representative Smith's child reunification bill second, and then Representative Erickson, and then Representative Smith's child support flip-flop of child versus I'm drawing a blank. Anyways, his fourth bill last. So, Representative Woodard, welcome to our committee. And I understand you've also got an A6 amendment that you would like to orally amend. But let's first, the chair will move SF-55 be recommended to pass. And does this
general register?
And re-referred to the general register. Representative Woodard, that motion is in front of us, and then to get it in the shape you would like, and maybe you could briefly explain the amendment, the chair will move the A6 amendment to House File SF-55. Representative Woodard, why don't you briefly explain the amendment, and then we'll get that and then we'll get that in the shape you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A6 amendment is language that we wanted to change within Senate File 55 based on conversations we had in the Education Reform Committee. So it is a reflection of conversations between the department, the charter schools, and the authorizers. The First Amendment does change the reporting, that dissemination to authorizers, and it put some language in there that kind of is some comfort language on anonymized data that is that ensures that the CellCamp data is sufficient to protect student identity, so that the information that the authorizers are looking for here from the department will be fully anonymous. The next thing it does is it eliminates any...
Representative Holbert.
Yes, I'm wondering, are we... The A6 amendment doesn't match up with the Senate File 55, and I'm wondering, is there host language that we're inserting?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I'm looking at my packet.
Representative Woodard, is that the oral amendment that they've said that needs to be made?
Mr. Chair, I believe that you have the wrong, potentially have the wrong Senate file, the wrong version. The engrossment from the Education Reform Committee is substantially longer than the one you have there, I think. I think you have the original Senate File 55.
Mr. Chair, I'm not seeing the right document.
Very, very good
in our file.
Observation. Ms. Aves, do you have
Mr. Chair,
any insight on this?
The amendment is to the first unofficial engrossment. We have the original bill in front of us. That's the difference. We do not have a copy of the unofficial engrossment here in the committee.
Okay. I understand Sarah is going to get copies. You know what? I think we should pause until we get that. Representative Woodard, would that be all right? Would you be able to hold up for just a little bit? We need to get the right engrossment in front of the committee members. And so with that, the chair will move to lay House File SF-55 on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. motion prevails. We'll bring it back up shortly here, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think with that, maybe I'll move to Representative Holberg. Is that all right, Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair?
Okay.
There's a DE1 amendment, House File 749, and an A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment.
Okay, let's walk through this. Representative Holberg will move House File 749 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary Committee. Second, we'll move the DE1 amendment. The chair moves the DE1 amendment to House File 749, and I'll further move the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment. Is that correct, Representative Holberg?
It is, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So let's vote on the A1 amendment first. A brief description, Representative Holberg, would that be helpful for the committee?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment is, for the most part, it is technical and it's renumbering, but it basically says that they cannot proceed further with the evidentiary hearing if the motion doesn't state that they meet the requirements.
Very good. Any discussion on the A1 amendment to amend the DE1 amendment? We'll be voting on the A1 amendment first. No discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now to the DE1 amendment.
One amendment before we can amend it.
As amended. Is there any discussion on the DE1 amendment? Representative Holberg, just give a brief
Mr. Chair, again, I'm standing in for the bill author, Chair Smith, this morning, but this bill was brought to me by Mr. Elwood, who's also at the stand here with me today. And a little bit about my background. My parents did foster care for 35 years and took care of, for the most part, special needs children. But I had the opportunity to live with and experience children coming from all different backgrounds. And the one thing that I can tell you that's a standard amongst all children is that they want parents to love them. And the kids that we're trying to address in this particular bill are children whose parental rights have been terminated but have not been adopted by anybody else. So they're in the system, and through a very high standard, if the parents have rectified the conditions in their life that caused the initial need for the termination of their rights, and it only applies in a subset of cases. In other words, if there was abuse or sexual abuse, those parents would never ever qualify under this program. But if you have a child that's still in the system and you have birth parents or parent that have rehabbed, have set their life back in order, have reached a very, very high bar of rehabilitation, there is an opportunity for unification in very, very limited circumstances. Is this going to solve all the problems in the system? No. But it might help a handful of children each year that are still looking for that place to belong with parents that have turned their lives around and are fully capable, as determined by the court, to re-up their relationship with their biological kids. And I have Mr. Elwood here from Legal Services to add anything to that or answer questions.
Very good. Representative Holberg, I think just so we don't forget the procedure, I'm going to ask that we move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author or the presenters want, and then we'll go to Mr. Elwood, and then Representative Hillstrom has a question. On the DE1 amendment, any discussion to get the bill in the shape the author wants it? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now to the House File 749 as amended. Mr. Elwood, welcome to our committee. Why don't you give us a brief presentation, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. There are a few other testifiers as well.
And but let me say at the outset, first of all, let me thank Representative Holberg so much for stepping in and in Representative Smith's place. And I think she did an eloquent job of explaining, you know, what this is all about. And let me say also that, you know, I know that there are some really strong and sincere feelings on this bill by those who oppose it, and I want to be really clear that we have nothing but the utmost respect for those views and the people that hold them. There are about 1,200 children in foster care, and those children have had their those parents have had their parental rights terminated. Many of these folks, as Representative Holberg said, are never adopted and remain wards of the state. So once parental rights are terminated, there is currently no legal opportunity in the state to reunite that family. In some cases, these parents have voluntarily surrendered their rights. Some of those are teenagers. In other instances, drug or alcohol addiction has led to the termination, and still other cases, incarceration has resulted in the termination. Nine other states have provided a similar opportunity, as this bill seeks to do, to provide a limited right for folks to families to get back together, for children and parents to be legally reunited. And while in those states relatively few petitions occur, and a smaller amount obviously are granted, however, for those for whom this works, and those people who deserve a second chance to be a family, we believe should get one. This bill is supported by about 20 organizations, including the Children's Law Center, Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, the Ramsey County Human Services and Public Health Department, Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network, the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, the Juvenile Division, and the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. I just want to make a few more comments about the specifics of the bill. Want to make it clear that in order for a petitioner to prevail, they must clear a clear and convincing evidentiary standard. So we've raised the bar, we believe, pretty high. Interested parties, including the county, have to receive notice of the hearing, so everybody would have an opportunity to know about it and state their cases. There has to be a finding that the parents are fit and the child will be going to a safe home. And the bill provides that the petitioner has the burden of proof and it cannot be shifted. The process for folks who are over 18 is a little less rigid because these folks are adults. And so in that case, simply the parties must agree, the parties must be competent to agree, and of course the child cannot have been adopted. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Mr. Elwood, you mentioned a couple other testifiers. How many do you have?
There are three, Mr. Chair, and they will be extremely brief.
Okay. Let's have them come forward. If they could each state a 2 minutes or less, that would be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for our taped record, that would be great.
My name is Marquita Stevens. I am the director of the African American Adoption Agency. And I'll be brief because Representative Forberg has really done a good job describing the content of the bill. So there's not much to add other than my voice to support the bill. As African American Adoption Agency, we're a practicing agency for over 20 years, licensed throughout the state of Minnesota to do both foster care and adoption work. So we operate those two programs as well as a program to inform the community about ways to keep their kids out of child protection and safe at home. We also do the post-adopt services, which is counseling and the like to enable families to blend. Over the years, and I've been there since 99, we have seen several instances where kids would have benefited from being reunited with their families had that been legally possible. So based on the common prevailing research that's available to you, as well as our experience, we would suggest that the bill be passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Actually, let's get the other two witnesses, and then we'll go to questions. Thank you. Next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Well, welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Mark Hosney. I'm a vice president with the Council on Crime and Justice, which is a local nonprofit organization. And we are a member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of over 50 Minnesota organizations that have come together because we all believe that people should have the maximum opportunity to reach their full potential, to be restored to full membership in their communities and within their families. These organizations range in focus and philosophy and constituency from places like the Council on Crime and Justice, 180 Degrees, corrections organizations, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, recovery organizations, all that agree on this central principle. And we also have all seen that there are many ways that Minnesotans are held back from reaching their full potential, in many cases unreasonably, after they have some type of criminal record. And this bill is a good step in eliminating one of those barriers, a very important barrier, which is full restoration to somebody's status as a parent, their ability to contribute to their family, and in one way make amends for their past mistakes. Now, the members of the Second Chance Coalition do acknowledge that many times when people are given future opportunities, there have to be safeguards in place. Sometimes it may not be appropriate for somebody to do a certain type of thing after a certain type of background. And this bill does put some very strong safeguards in place, does not make it easy for somebody to be reunited with their child as a parent. And for that reason, we think it's a safe bill that will allow some people to be restored to their families. It will help children. It will help us as a state. One example of that is reducing costs to the state of supporting these children. For those reasons, the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition supports this bill, and we ask for and thank you for your support.
Very good. Thank you. Any one more testifier?
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, I appreciate brevity, and please state your name for the record.
Kimberly White. I'm here today. I have three children in the foster system now, and back in 2005, I was in a real bad situation, and I know I was in a real bad situation, and since October of 2007, I've been clean, and I've been getting my life together, and I want to have a healthy relationship with my children. And my mom had adopted my children and passed away right after she had full adoption. And I'm here because I want to be helped towards this bill because I want to have a relationship with my children, a healthy relationship. And I think this is a good opportunity to help others like myself, that have lost their rights and are in a position to take care of their children.
Very good. Is that, may I ask, is that your child?
Yes, this is my baby.
Okay. He wants to testify too. Boy or girl? He wants to testify too. Members, any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These questions are for Mr. Elwood, because I'll go easy on Representative Holberg, given this is Representative Smith's bill, and I will see it again in judiciary. Mr. Elwood, the standard is very, very high to terminate parental rights on a child. And if you believe that these parents, after 24 months, can get their act together so that they can be reunified with their children, why don't you change the process of termination rather than do this backwards? Because once those rights are terminated, there are no support services for those parents to work towards reunification. So why did you choose to do it this way rather than choosing to actually not have the terminations happen and actually have support services for parents to successfully reunify?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, well, first of all, we have been working with both the Department of Human Services, and we have had discussions with the county attorneys in the past, and they there was some suggestions about increasing the time period before which a petition would be able to be made. We were open to some sort of a modification of the time period. But to answer your question directly, this this bill has come out of our Youth Law Project, which has been working with these folks in the foster care system. And this is the route that they thought, under the current framework of the statute, that and that would be the most workable, the least cost, and also other states have taken, as I said, 9 other states have taken this type of approach in that situation.
Mr. Chair, if I might back to that, I think if you look on page 2, lines 24 and 25, it says that they have to be in foster care at least 24 months after termination. So it's very likely, I mean, termination doesn't happen immediately. I'm not sure exactly what the time frame is. And so there would be a longer period of time during the termination process. So, I mean, I understand your concern, but I think it'd be a little longer than 24 months. And, of course, also for that 24-month period, that child would have been eligible for adoption and have not been chosen by somebody else as well.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Elwood,
just want to also be clear that if a child is, if there's a pending adoption as well, if they're in the process, that would also eliminate the right of anybody to petition. So it's not just that they've already been adopted, but if they're already in the process. And I do have our supervisor of our supervising attorney of the Youth Law Project here with me, and if you'd like additional information about on your question, Representative Hillstrom, we can bring her up if you'd like for more information.
Representative Hillstrom, does that satisfy your
question, Mr. Chair, and then I just have a statement.
Okay, go ahead.
That's okay. I do not support this proposal at all. Every child wants to be loved and always looks back and says, my parent is coming back for me. And this gives false hope. Gives false hope. So I'll be a no, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, are there any scenarios in Minnesota where parental rights or parent-child relationship has been restored in the wake of a termination that you are aware of?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Ms. Opsahl to come in and respond to that question.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Lesh, what do you mean in the wake of? I mean, prior to it being finalized or after it was finalized?
After it was finalized, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, after everything is said and done, despite the lack of this law, have there been scenarios where a judge has reestablished a parent-child relationship, what this law would reportedly do, despite the fact of there being no express statute in place to do it? For example, was did a judge ever do this in equity or under common law understanding?
Yes, I can answer.
You can identify yourself for the record.
My name is Irene Upsall. I'm the supervisor of the Youth Law Project at the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis.
Okay.
And in discussing this bill with the County Attorneys Association, they did mention that there have been a couple of cases over the years where not strictly a reestablishment of the parent-child relationship, though, that a parent got a guardianship of an older child after the parental rights were terminated. But it's a clumsy proceeding, and this kind of clarifies that there are those few cases where, and not just a guardianship, but actually the parent-child relationship can be restored.
Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, just by way of comment, members, I am a co-author on this bill, and I'm a co-author for a reason. I think first of all, any judge who is considering reestablishment of a parent-child relationship under this law is going to do so very, very carefully. One of the reasons which a previous judge had already terminated parental rights, and it's going to make them nervous about that, but also just with the public policy of all the work that it took to terminate those rights in the first place, I think a judge is going to be very circumspect. So I think this is going to be applied in a few select situations. But also, members, I think that this is a body that believes in redemption for parents that have screwed up and have come around again. I know, for example, Representative Hillstrom has worked in the trenches on this and is personally impacted by this and has strong opinions on it, as do many people throughout this. That said, I think an open door of redemption is absolutely critical because while this body places the best interests of children at the top, to do that in a vacuum without recognizing any possibility of redemption, I think is not the kind of state that I want to live in. So that's why I'll be supporting it, because I think it will be applied in the most important and select circumstances.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Elwood or the author. I believe that this had some roots, and a couple, 3 years ago, there were some discussions about this. And I'm working off memory, which is always bad, but it was to be geared towards older children. So I have a couple of questions about that. But you, before I get to that, you spoke 9 other states have done this or are doing this.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, 9 other states have laws in place.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Do you have any documentation of age brackets that these cases in these 9 other states have dealt with? And the reason I'm going there is I am uncomfortable. My sense was that this was supposed to primarily be for older children that the courts pretty much said, you know, if you're 12, you have some say. But if you're 8 or 9, you are unlikely to have say in what's going to happen in your parenting plan, so to speak. So could you tell me if those states have had some history with this and what that history might be?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, first of all, you're right, the bill has been around for several years, and it has always been in this format. So we have always had a very wide breadth of you know, who can petition and what children would be involved. Because, I mean, if you think about it, one of the target audiences here are teenage parents who have messed up and lost their rights. And so, I mean, if you think about it, you know, if 5-7 years down the road, they're cleaned up, the child is 6 or 7 years old. So we don't think, I mean, there, again, it's the one size fits all. But to answer your question about the other states, we have a variety of provisions. Some states, Washington, for example, if there's cause shown, it doesn't matter what the age is. And Washington is probably has the most experience and is the most robust state with respect to having experience with this statute. There are relatively few petitions each year, and I think that's the one that is probably most like us. California and Nevada, there are no age restrictions. In Hawaii and New York, it would be a child 14 or older. Louisiana and Oklahoma, a child 15 or older. So, again, it just varies among the states. Some allow a child would be eligible at any age, and others do put some floor on there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So are you saying Washington, you alluded that Washington's statutes are similar to this particular bill. So are you saying that Washington has a lenient perception to this, to reuniting parents with their children? And if that's a yes, how many children have been reunited with their parents in the state of Washington, or if you have that number?
Mr. Owen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I do. And let me just be clear. Washington, it starts out with a child who is 12, but a child who is younger may also be reunited. So that's the sort of the statutory framework. As far as how many folks have been, how many petitions have been approved, I have the last, the law's been in place, I think, for 5 years, but I have only 3 years of data. And it's really only been about a half a dozen.
In the 3 years?
Yes, but there's only also been about, let me see, like about 20 petitions. So
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So I'm going to try to help you clarify this.
Uh-huh.
There's been 20 petitions, six have been granted, is that correct?
About that. That's
okay. Now, Mr. Chair, thank
Mahoney.
You. I have a couple of other questions.
Go ahead.
I'll try to get through this quickly. On page 3, line 6, you talk about who needs to be notified. Is there a list of people who need to be notified? Do you have it pretty clearly laid out? Because, you know, maybe an uncle twice removed might be upset by this, or an aunt three times removed. Are they on that list? And then you go down to page 3, line 28. You say both parent and child desire reestablishment of parent-child relationship. And this is the more important one to me. At what age does that child, because your bill is not specific at all, at what age does that child have a say in that? Because I have witnessed judges ordering upwards of $10,000 worth of psychological counseling for all parents, and I'm wondering who gets to pay for that, and can they order that, and who gets to pay for that?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, to answer your first question, the statutory requirements for the notice would be in Subdivision 5 on lines 3.10 to 3.16. So the child's foster parent and any other person or entity, which would include the county, that's the primary entity, who would have standing to bring a motion under the bill. So those are the statutory requirements for notice. To answer your second question, in terms of the evidence that has to be presented to meet the clear and convincing evidentiary standard, there are requirements that the guardians are required to make findings that this is an appropriate situation. So, again, I think your question goes to if it's a very young child, you know, so there would be a guardian involved. If it's an older child, then the judge can determine the how that child's views should be taken into account. And also, there is another provision in here that does allow the judge to take the child in sort of, you know, in a more informal setting, so they're not in the courtroom. That's a typical procedure in other instances, and that would apply here. So that if the child wants to talk to the judge privately and not in the presence of the parent or the court, they can do so.
Representative Mahoney, any follow up?
Yes. So there's really no age set here for a child to say, yes, I want this, without having to go through numerous hoops. And we're relying on the judge, because no child is going to ask to talk to the judge in private with their parents or the person of authority in their life sitting next to them. I think the concept of the bill is right. I would prefer that it was primarily for older children, because I think that's where you're trying to get at, with children having difficulty being adopted over the age of XYZ. And frankly, if a child comes from a dysfunctional family, they walk into a courtroom or they walk into any situation. They walk into any situation and they immediately try to figure out either how am I going to be manipulated, and they don't use that word, or how do I manipulate the situation. I don't think your bill is right there yet. I really think you've got a glaring hole in it. I'm going to vote to pass it along. You've worked pretty hard on many issues when you've been made aware of things. I'm going to trust you to do that. And I'm glad that you used the clear and convincing evidence issue there.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. I'm wondering if this particular bill would keep children from being adopted or even wanting to be adopted, because of the idea of reunification is always there in sight, and I know once someone starts the adoption process, this isn't in place. But I'm wondering, even the idea that it's there for children, especially older children, would they not want to be adopted, or would there be a barrier to adoption with this in place?
Good question, Representative or Mr. Elwood. Any thoughts on that,
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson? What the folks that we've been working with in the adoption agencies and in the foster care system tell us is that, regardless of what the law says, children always want to be back with their parents. That's the case right now, and there is no legal opportunity for reunification. I don't think that's going to change with or without this bill. So I do not believe that this would have an impact one way or the other on whether kids will be adopted or not. There are, as I said before, there are 1,200 children in foster care. Many of them will never be adopted with or without this bill.
Members, Mr. Kingery from the County Attorneys Association is asked to testify as well. With no further questions, I'll ask him to come and state his testimony. Mr. Kingery, if you can stay to the point in brief, we are going to try to stay on time here if we can. And is there anybody else that plans or came to testify in opposition today or support? If you can pass your name or have a page come and get your name, they can bring it up to us so we know. Mr. Kingery, welcome to our committee. If you can state your name for the record, as you know.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. excuse me, regrettably, you get the backup quarterback today.
Ditto.
Right.
She's a pretty good quarterback, Mr. Kingery.
And the and actually, we have expressed our concern to Representative Smith, so he is aware that we do have concern. And my hope is, if the bill does pass out of committee today, that we can have some discussion between now and judiciary if it's to move forward. Last week, I had two assistant county attorneys who were prepared to testify, as well as a couple of county social workers. I know their statewide organization has supported this, but we have heard from a number of county social workers in the field that they have some concern with regard to this bill. You know, I can't imagine, I'll get into my remarks in just a second, I can't imagine anything more terrible than having your parental rights terminated. For those of us that have children, I just can't imagine a worse scenario than to lose your child in that manner. To terminate parental rights is not an easy process. It is a very challenging, a very expensive, a very time-consuming process. We have worked with legal aid and the proponents of this legislation for probably the last 18 months. And I'll be very frank with you, I pushed my folks real hard to try to find some middle ground to somehow narrow the scope of this bill. And at the end of the day, we just weren't able to achieve that. And I'm hoping that we can begin those discussions today. As it was stated earlier, kids always want to get, not always, but kids typically want to get back with their parents. The reason with terminating parental rights, children need to heal from that process and to move on. And although they may want to return to their families of origin, it doesn't always mean that it is in their best interest to do that. And the reappearance of a birth parent is not always in the best interest of the child. It flies in the face of permanency. The child's been told parental rights have been terminated. It flies in the face of permanency and the child moving on in either the foster care situation or adoption. And now we're saying termination doesn't really mean termination. Give it a couple years and we'll see what things look like. Yes, I do believe in redemption. I think that's very important. And I think that needs to be part of that discussion. And so we're saying termination is okay until you change your mind, and that's not permanency. And children being children, if it's not clear that this is going to be the path you're going to go down, they're not going to, in our mind, cooperate with the services and the programs that are available to them if they think there's a chance they can get back with their with the birth parent. We also question that for children over 18 who are now adults, it appears that they would then go back into juvenile court. We believe that family court would be a more appropriate situation for that those situations. Also, we believe the burden will fall on the local agency and the county attorney to oppose such a motion and to reinvestigate matters that have already been resolved through a TPR. If the motion is granted, a case plan must be developed, including supervision services beyond what has already been provided. The burden, we believe, will fall on the county to establish reasons for not agreeing to the reestablishment of a parent's rights. Also, the bill calls for the motion to be scheduled at a regularly scheduled review hearing. But the parent, whose parental rights have been terminated, have no right to be at a review hearing. In fact, they don't even know that there's a review hearing taking place. And so we're not sure how that process would be to notify them. The responsible social service agency must file an assessment on whether the parent's home constitutes a safe environment for the child. We're talking about a home study basically here. And with the timelines in the bill, we're not sure that a sufficient home study can be done in order to make some sort of an assessment to the court. Also, as you know, the state has already terminated the parental rights, and we have some concern that the parents may not be in the best frame of mind, if you will, to cooperate with that county social agency that has just terminated the parental rights some 2 or 3 years earlier. Also, if the parent has moved away, we're not sure, you know, hundreds of miles away, we're not sure exactly how that process would work. The bill does say that the parent has no right to a court-appointed attorney, but I believe that the child will. I assume possibly through public defenders or whoever would represent that child. And I know there's been a discussion about this will only apply to a small number of children. And so far that has certainly been the experience in the other states. I'm not sure that will be the case here in Minnesota. I think upon the termination of parental rights, I think both the parent and the child will be informed of this process. And again, we're concerned that it does fly in the face of permanency, and the parent is not going to move on if they believe there's a chance to get back and the child won't cooperate and avail themselves of the services that are available. With that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that concludes my testimony this morning, and would be happy to answer any questions by the backup here.
Thank you, Mr. Kingery. Question, could the reverse possibly be true? And Representative Peterson asked, does it set up a situation where the child doesn't ever want to be adopted because they always have a false hope of getting to their parents? Could it not work as an incentive also for parents that are rehabilitating their life as a pretty extreme reward or incentive for changing their lives? Wouldn't that be a possibility as well, Mr. Kingery?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think that is a very strong possibility that it would prove to be an incentive for that parent. I'm not sure if 2 years is sufficient time in order to do that. You know, again, these things are not just done on a whim. They're very complicated. They're very emotional, gut-wrenching cases. And what led to that termination can't always be resolved or turned around in 2 years or less.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Kingray, about that possibility of holding out false hope for a kid who right now you could say, no, it's done, fini, move on, get over it, which can, as someone suggests, help the process of closure and healing. I'm wondering at what age you can reasonably say that to a kid, for example, if it's going to take 2 years in order for any kind of reunification to happen. Well, let me ask a question first. Is there anything, Mr. Kingray, that prohibits a child from whom, where there has been parental rights terminated, is there anything prohibiting a kid from having a relationship with that parent after they turn 18?
Mr. Kingray.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, I'm going to make the educated guess that there is nothing that would interfere with the reestablishing the relationship where you have an adult child.
Okay. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Then my that leads to my, I think that I'm sure that's probably true, I'm guessing, Mr. Kingray. So that would mean that really latest age at which this would be a possibility for a kid is if they were 16, since it takes 2 years for that to happen, and by the time you turn 18, what's the point? Because you can have a relationship, albeit not one of necessarily dependency with tax return and whatnot. So if I'm a 14-year-old kid, Mr. Kingray, is that a long enough period of time where under the current system I could have my hopes crushed, and I'm sorry to put it pejoratively, but where I could reasonably think this is done, I can move on? Otherwise, could a kid say, well, in 4 years, if nothing else, I'll still get to see my parent and have a relationship with them because I'll be 18? Or is 12 a long enough time for that that hope to sort of dissipate? And if not, is it 10? My question is, are there any studies suggesting at what age a child, despite the status quo of the law, can reasonably expect to end their hopes and move on? Are there any studies you know of that exist to say that?
Mr. Kingray.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I'm not aware of any studies, but I assume there is. And that was one of, and I did indicate that we had worked with Legal Aid, and we again attempted to resolve our concerns. And one of the biggest debates was, could we do an age? You know, at what point below which that this wouldn't apply to? And we just couldn't agree on an age. But I assume that there are studies that would point to the information you want, but I'm not aware of them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask, and I don't, those were not rhetorical questions. I, as many people around this community know, am a stubborn SOB, and I don't care how young I was, I would SOB and the SOB. And I don't care how young I was, I would be nursing that hope ad infinitum. But I'm sure that's not the norm, and so I would, if anyone knows of any studies, I'd like to see one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just say we have other legislation that's been moving through on adopted persons seeking their original birth certificate. And based upon the testimony we've heard related to that bill, I would say it's never over for kids, no matter if they're 35 years old, 40 years old. It's never over. So that idea of that there's going to be some age where there's no hope of reunification is just fictional, I think. And I think there would be plenty of studies from the classic adoption context that would bear that out.
Any further questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really not a question, but I want to reiterate, when I spoke first, I thought that there had not been a lot of discussion about an age limit that this worked towards. Again, I want to strongly say that there should be an age limit to where these children can participate, that this law can take effect, whether it's 12 or 14. Because at a certain point, children should have some say. But if we've terminated the parental rights, there's an awfully good reason. And 2 years is not very long if you've made a mess of your life. If you're drugs and alcohol, 2 years isn't even a drop in the bucket. 5 years might suffice. 7 years might be better because of some of the stuff that I have experienced in my life. I know that there's a huge drop-off from alcohol and drug recovery after 5 years. So I would really strongly urge Mr. Elwood and company and the author of the bill to find an age that works for this, because frankly, well, I think fire is a strong word, but I think somebody, you're playing with something that could really hurt somebody.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hobart.
I certainly will have conversations with the bill author, and as Representative Lesh stated earlier, Mr. Elwood has a strong reputation down here of working with all sides and trying to come to resolution. So I think there is opportunity for some improvement in this bill. I've heard some alternative views today, but I think that there's ways to make this bill a little better. I think the how do you protect the child and the ability for one-on-one dialogue with the judge outside of, you know, any type of contact with the terminated parent, you know, as a first step even before you would even go forward with that. I think there are some changes that could make this bill better. So we're certainly willing to work, and Representative Hillstrom has stated some very valid concerns as well that I'll also share with Chair Smith.
Any further questions, members? Mr. Elwood, you've heard some comments. It's your inclination to maybe try to massage this a little more going forward, and it's going to Judiciary Committee, as I understand.
Mr. Chair, we have had a lot of discussion with the county attorneys and would be more than happy to continue those discussions. And Representative Mahoney, we will certainly look to see if we can accommodate the concerns that you have raised. We are more than willing to do that, yes.
And Mr. Elwood, I've got some thoughts, but I'll talk to you offline afterwards just to move on. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who this is a question for exactly, but if I'm reading the bill correctly, the agreement by the child to the reestablishment of the parent-child relationship is only a factor that would be considered by the court. In other words, it's not really necessarily required. Mr. Elwood, perhaps, or Representative Holberg, is that something you're comfortable with?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, it is a factor, but it is a required factor. So without that agreement, the petition could not be approved.
In fact, Mr. Chair, if
Representative Holberg.
On page 4, line 23, you can see that the child has to agree to reestablishment, and then if you look on page 4, lines 33 and 34, it says the court must consider as the paramount determinant whether granting the motion is the child's best interest.
Any further discussion? Members, Mr. Letourneau was here in support and said that he's going to email the committee. He'll email it to John probably, and we'll forward his testimony in support of this bill. Any further discussion? With no further discussion, the chair, Representative Holberg, renews her motion to pass House File 749 as amended.
Mr. Chair, I think it's Senate File 54.
Wait.
Amendment.
I think that's Representative Woodard's bill. Representative
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm in a time warp today.
Kelby's cheering you on back there.
If only it was that easy, right?
And so the Representative Holbrook does renew her motion to pass House File 749 as amended and refer it to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Oh.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Representative Woodard, come on back. The time pressure is on. Representative Woodard, the chair is going to make a motion to take from the table Senate File 55. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Logistically, where we were at, members, the wrong engrossment was copied and got erroneously put in the packets. You now have the unofficial engrossment, first unofficial engrossment, and that is the bill we are working off of. Representative Woodard has an oral. We've moved the A6 amendment. He has asked that we have an oral amendment to the A6 amendment. To get that in the shape, the amendment should be, I would like to move that oral amendment and ask Ms. Aves to repeat it for the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, on the amendment line 1.10, after the word must, insert direct the charter school that they.
Repeat that one more time for the members.
Line 1.10, after the word must, insert direct the charter school that they.
Everybody got that amendment? Any discussion? All those in favor of the oral, Representative Hilty. Representative Hilty. This is the oral amendment.
On line 1.62. Oh, to the amendment. Oh, okay.
It's to the A6 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. This might be a sophistry, Mr. Chair, but technically under law, is a charter school a they or an it? We're talking about an entity. Maybe that's the terminology we're using in statute, but that was just my question.
I don't know the answer.
And if there is no designation, then I'm not making a motion, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Aves, any comment, quick or not?
Mr. Chair and members, I do not staff the Education Committee, so I do not know the answer to that.
A trivial question we can carry forward, Representative Woodard, if not a legal question. I think we'll move on to the oral amendment. Any further questions on the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, just in quick conversation,
Representative
here,
Woodard.
I believe it is probably the right term as opposed to they.
Yes.
So if we can make that.
So we'll modify the oral amendment. Ms. Aves, I'll incorporate that correction in my oral. Do you want to restate that one more time then for the committee and the record?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, to the A6 amendment, line 1.10, after must, insert, direct the charter school that it.
Everybody clear on that? All those in favor of the oral amendment to the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now to the A6 amendment. Representative Woodard, I'm going to propose we get that on the bill and then you present the bill or review it as you intend with the amended language on. Is there any further discussion on the A6 or can we get it in the shape the author wants it? All those in favor of the A6 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now, to Senate File 55 as amended, Representative Woodard, the unofficial first engrossment is what we're discussing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And as brief as you can be,
I will.
let's stick to the liability issues.
Okay.
Primarily, if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And in essence, the bill before us is the same bill that we passed on the House floor as part of the Education Finance Omnibus Bill. And as we continue to work with players within this community, the authorizers and the charter schools and department, we've continued to clean up some additional language as we've identified issues and tried to address that in this bill. Right now we have 62 charter schools that do not have an authorizer, and this is based on the fact that the authorizer bill was passed by the legislature in 2009 and had some more stringent requirements upon authorizers. And the department's in favor of us extending that deadline to September 30th. Right now the deadline's June 30th, but allows those charter schools to continue to operate and allow those parents to know the status of those charter schools. It does change a few things. It does add some identification language that this committee would be interested in. And it also adds some requirements that the department provide reporting information to the authorizers so that they can better determine the success of the charter schools that they authorize. And by doing that, it basically just asks that the department provide them with anonymous data. And we did add some language that's part of the A6 amendment that we approved that ensures the anonymous nature of that data. So if the cell that we're looking at has too few students, the department will make sure that information is not provided to the authorizer, but it's language that does allow them to have some more detailed information about the success of the charter schools that they have. And, Mr. Chair, that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Woodard. Do you have any testifiers that you had planned on having testify?
None that I have planned, but there may be some if anybody has checked in, Mr. Reynolds.
Is there anybody here that came to specifically to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Why don't you come forward, sir?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. We do have a concern on page 11, the section on indemnification and holding harmless the commissioner and authorizer. This is a radically new provision that no other public charter school, no other public school or public entity is charged with. So we would be required to indemnify and hold harmless the commissioner of an illegal action by the commissioner or an authorizer. And there is no provision for regular public schools to do this, so we oppose this provision.
Very good. Did you say 16 charter schools you represent, or where did I hear 16?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, 62.
62
charter schools.
Oh, okay. Is that how many we have in our state, Representative Woodard?
No. How many, Eugene?
Mr. Chair, there are 149 operating charter schools in the state, 62 of which are in this limbo because of the change in the law 2 years ago.
Okay. And can you just drill down a little further on the limbo that?
Mr. Chair, members, 2 years ago we had a major revision of the charter school law, the first one in 18 years since the law was passed. One of the provisions of that law was that we put in an approval process for authorizers. We used to call them sponsors. Up until 2 years ago, all you had to do to be an authorizer or a sponsor was to meet one of the categories, be a school district, a college or university, or a nonprofit. 2 years ago, we put in a provision that requires authorizers to seek approval by the commissioner and demonstrate they have the competence and the capacity to do the oversight role. Two years were given for that process to take place. Unfortunately, it took about 9 months just to get that process up and running for people to apply. And so we're running against the timeline. So basically, one of the provisions of this bill is to extend that for another. If they can apply by September 30th, they can extend the extend authorization until next June. After next June of 2012, if you have not been approved, you're out of business.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I correct, Mr. Piccolo, in your objection to unofficial engrossment 11.29 to 11.39, your objection is that district schools do not have the same type of requirement. Is that true?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, that's true.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I can, Mr. Piccolo, are you suggesting that charter schools, as creatures of statutes, are not given other benefits that district schools do not have? Do you dispute that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, charter schools have some benefits, but they also have some liabilities also. For example, they do not have the power to tax like a traditional school district.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Mr. Piccolo, I can't understand this because it's been 20 years now since you've had this these laws in place, and I'm wondering when the time has come to separate the wheat from the chaff. And good charter schools come up here and testify and say, come on, give us some more rope here. You're restricting our actions. And the bad ones don't come up and testify. And when there are some questions about how we ensure, for example, district schools is quite obvious. I mean, why, you know, you're going to sue the commissioner for what? I mean, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's the jobs of the local districts to educate students. If they're not doing their job, they're under other types of regulation and constriction to do that, and the students go to another school and district school. With charter school, it's not just your job to track the students and see how they're learning. You need to perpetuate the enterprise because it's your enterprise and your charter school that the money is flowing, state money, taxpayer dollars are flowing to you to ensure that you perpetuate the enterprise. So if you're saying, well, we don't want this language regarding indemnification because if, in fact, we cannot sue the commissioner, it threatens the enterprise, not how the kids are going to get educated, but the enterprise itself. It's not going to impact the good actors because there are plenty of good actor charters out there. So why is it that you can defend the bad actors still on this?
Mr. Piccolo?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, first of all, to correct something, there have been 38 charter schools closed in the state in the last 20 years. So a lot of bad actors have been put out of business. This does not protect bad actors. This says that if the state or the authorizer does something wrong, that the school is held, is required to indemnify the state or the authorizer. Not if the school does something wrong, if the authorizer does something wrong.
Well,
so Representative Lesch.
Thank you. The question remains the same. I mean, to a certain extent, the authorizers are part of the actors in perpetuating the enterprise. So it's the principle. Unless I'm mistaken about this, it allows the charter school to remain a valid going concern. With this language, it makes it more difficult. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, we do not think so because there is a limit. Charter schools have the same limitation in terms of liability as any other government entity. So there's no advantage here to do something wrong. This is about if the commissioner and the authorizer do something wrong that threatens the existence of the school, even if it's a good school.
So
you're held liable for their actions.
Mr. Piccolo, that's kind of the key issue here.
Yes.
So if the commissioner does something wrong to harm students in your charter school, this language would require you to indemnify the commissioner, i.e. the Department of Education, or the authorizer.
Mr. Chair.
And that's your contention.
Mr. Chair, that's our contention, yes.
Representative Woodard, what's the purpose? What is the reason we should indemnify the commissioner or an authorizer from bad acting?
Mr. Chair, this is language that the department prefers, and after a consultation with the AG's office and some of the concerns that they have, I am willing, and we certainly work very closely with Mr. Piccolo and his group. And my understanding, and just a brief conversation he and I had this morning, there may be some additional language that would help this and help his issue, and we'll continue to work with him on that. But there are some issues within the charter school community that we're concerned about, and authorizers have also expressed that this would be helpful to them.
So Mr. Woodard, Representative Woodard, do we indemnify public schools? And I think the answer is, I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I believe the answer to that is yes.
I asked that wrong, Representative Woodruff. Do public schools indemnify the Commissioner of Education from any wrongdoing?
That's a different question, and I believe that we do not do that with public schools today, but I don't know that for a fact.
Representative Leshen, I'm not sure if you and I are on the same page here or not. I'm to Mr. Pickerel's testimony, I'm puzzled why we would indemnify a separate agency that theoretically the charter school doesn't have control over what they do or don't do right. Agencies aren't always perfect either. And so, Representative Lesh?
My understanding, Mr. Chair, is this. There's no point in having one unit of government indemnify another unit of government. We're talking about a charter school here, or I'm sorry, we're talking about a district school, which is a creature of state statute. Just like a city is a creature of state statute, I mean, there are home rule charter cities and counties which also have, home rule charter, but the fact is they're still creatures of state statute. Charter schools are, but they're not a unit of government. So they're being a separate entity, they're looking for a separate provision to, for the department is looking for a provision to indemnify them so that the separate independent outfit, independent going concern, cannot sue the commissioner that threatens the going concern if there is an adverse decision made by the commissioner or individuals named in the language on that page. That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. So commissioner and authorizers.
Where's this bill going, Representative Woodard?
Well, this will go, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This will go to the General Register.
General Register.
Now, Mr. Chair, and I, almost it's difficult for me to say, but Representative Lesha did a very good job of of describing this particular issue, and so I appreciate that. You think you're exactly right in your assertion here.
I did have a couple other questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh, and then Representative Druskowski.
I'm assuming, Mr. Piccolo, you probably agree with the provision striking the end of your fund balance of $2 million requirement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes.
Okay.
We support that because, as I mentioned earlier, the requirement now is that you have to demonstrate that you have the capacity to do the job rather than some arbitrary amount of money you have in as net assets, as a nonprofit.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative
if I could, Mr. Piccolo, so what are the charter schools, the names of the charter schools that would benefit from this law change, who just don't have the cash on hand, they run a narrow profit margin or what have you, of course it's not profit because they're not technically for-profit entities, but they run on slim margins. They don't have $2 million in the bank, but they've operated continuously for 5 years. What are the names of the charter schools that would benefit from this legal change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, that provision is not about charter schools. It's about authorizers. And the one, for example, would be the German-American Institute, which is an authorizer of Twin City German Immersion School. Most of their assets are in terms of property. And with the real estate slump, their property values have fallen under $2 million.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
So this is not about schools. This is that provision strictly about authorizers.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm not tracking this well because the whole point, I think, of having these legal changes that impact authorizers is because they authorize charter schools. So if it adversely impacted an authorizer, therefore a charter school who was supported by that authorizer would then be an orphan and have to search out another authorizer. Am I correct?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Lesh, that would be true. As I mentioned, the one case would be, for example, the German-American Institute, which sponsors the Twin City German Immersion School. They would have to find a new authorizer, correct?
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, maybe I can rephrase my question then. That'd be my question. Mr. Chair, is the German Immersion School then the only outfit that would be beneficially impacted by this legal change, or are there other charter schools? And if I need to rephrase it, Mr. Piccolo, let me know. If I need to say, are there other schools who are supported by authorizers like the German American Institute who would be beneficially impacted by this change?
Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, it's hard to know at this moment because we are in this transition period where every authorizer is making the decision whether to continue under the new requirements. We have seen school districts who have withdrawn as authorizers. We've seen colleges and universities, and we've seen some nonprofits withdraw because they do not want to meet the new standards to be an authorizer. So I can only give you that as one example of that provision. But that provision, as I say, was put in the legislative language many years ago as a way of ensuring that a nonprofit just doesn't start up and become an authorizer out of the blue.
Okay.
Now authorizers must meet new standards that are very rigid by the Department of Education.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, and this is just by way of closing comment, I don't think it's a surprise to Mr. Piccolo to know that I don't think they're rigid enough. I think there are charter schools in my district, good charter schools, who do just fine under their requirements. No one wants to be regulated, but the good actors are well within the penumbra of contemplation of regulation that this committee or any other education committee is even considering in the past couple of years. The bad actors are either on the edge or well outside of it, as Mr. Piccolo suggested, that some schools have been closed. But I have specific interest in charter schools in and around St. Paul who are not good actors and have still found ways to work around the system, come in the back door, and remain profitable going concerns. And I would like to know whether these legal changes are going to make it easier for them to be predators of our kids or harder. And so that's why I asked the question. Mr. Piccolo doesn't know. He doesn't know. But it's what I think of when I go forward and vote on these bills.
Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we supported the language 2 years ago. We support almost everything in this bill because we have seen in the last 2 years that we need to tweak some things to make it clear the accountability. We are not opposed to accountability, never have been. We have supported closing schools where they have not done their job and will continue to.
Mr. Piccolo, Representative Drazkowski has a question, but is there particular cases that are bringing this forward, or is it just the 2 years ago, the change, and the timeline needs to be modified a little bit here, or what might be, is there particular cases in mind that's generating this legislation? And then Representative Drazkowski has a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, in terms of the extension, the one-year extension, that is, as I mentioned, because 2 years ago there was a major change in the law. It took about 9 months just for the department to get the process in place, and it's an extensive process that authorizers need to go through to get approval. So we have about 62 schools that are currently in this limbo situation of trying to get an authorizer. Some of their authorizers are still in the process of approval. And it takes quite a while for that process to go forward. So all this would do is allow those authorizers who authorized those schools before 2 years ago to continue for one more year to be able to get approval. We have had several authorizers withdraw from being an authorizer, and those schools are seeking transfers to new authorizers. And there's a very extensive review process done by the Department of Education on those two. So basically, it's just amounting to allowing more time to get the new law put in place.
What about the indemnification? What's driving that issue?
You'd have to ask those that are in favor of that what's driving that, Mr. Chair. As I say, we see there is some major problems with that. and we have indicated we're continuing to willing to work with Representative Woodard on that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm maybe as confused as everyone else, but I would just point out, members, page 11 in the part that Representative Lesh pointed to relates to what a contract must contain, and it says a contract must contain that indemnity which indemnifies both the commissioner and the authorizer. If you look at page 22 of the bill, you'll see the language from statute that suggests that there already is immunity from civil or criminal liability on lines 22.14 through 22.16. And then there's kind of a repeat there of new language that kind of really just reflects that, is what I gather. So, Mr. Piccolo, I'm still trying to understand the language better myself, but it doesn't seem to be real radical anyway. Can you explain a little more, Mr. Piccolo? Maybe what would be helpful for me is to understand the process just quickly in bulleted rapid-fire form here. If you would point out how these charter schools are formed in the contract negotiations with the authorizer, the commissioner, and the school. I read a little bit on the top of page 11 that kind of gives some direction to that, but if you could clear up the mud a little bit, it might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the way a charter is chartered is that a group of people, teachers, parents, and community members come together, they put together a application, they seek out an authorizer. An authorizer does a process of due diligence, of review. They have to document their process of review of whether or not they will charter that school. That affidavit is submitted to the Commissioner of Education for review and approval. If there is anything in there that they have not followed the process, they have not dealt with certain issues, that can be kicked back to the authorizer for a redo, basically. At that point, if the affidavit from the authorizer is approved by the commissioner, the school group and the authorizer sit down and negotiate a charter contract, which has provisions that are listed in law, including academic outcomes, operational outcomes, financial outcomes for the school. That is then approved by both the board of directors of the charter school and the authorizer's board of overseers. Then that is submitted to the commissioner, and that becomes the framework on which the authorizer reviews and holds accountable the school for its operations. Initial contracts can be up to 3 years. Renewing contracts can now be up to 5 years. During that time, an authorizer does regular oversight of the school, attending board meetings, reviewing all the documents of the school, its financial reports. It does site visits. It does a formal evaluation before the renewal of a contract. And then at the time of the contract renewal, it makes a decision whether or not this school has made progress. Excuse me, my mouth is so dry. In fulfilling its terms, or it is not doing its job like it set out, and the authorizer can withdraw the contract and say, school, you're out of business. If it is done for cause, that school must disband and go out of business. If they are renewed, there's a new contract signed with new goals and objectives, and the process just repeats itself.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. That's helpful. So what this new language here is basically saying or suggesting is that in that whole arrangement that the charter school will agree not to sue either the commissioner or the authorizer or whatever. I don't know exactly. What are the items that they could be suing them for?
Mr. Piccolo.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, if you look at the provisions under law in which the charter is renewed. One provision is a general provision about other good cause shown, which is somewhat subjective. In terms of failure to meet pupil requirements, that is pretty much addressed in the contract, so that is not normally an issue. It's the vagueness of other cause shown, and also the fact that our lawyers have indicated that this would make the school also potentially responsible for something that the school had no control over. For example, if there was some liability that came to the school because of state, for example, the state testing program was messed up, which occurred several years ago, the school could be held responsible for that also. And part of this is the vagueness of this language, and that's our legal counsel's, and that's why we're continuing to work with Representative Woodard to try to clarify what this is really about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Piccolo, I've got two thoughts here. I'm either thinking we amend this language out because I think it's a little unclear, or Representative Woodard, we lay this bill over. I would feel better moving it out without that language. Do you have any thoughts, Representative Woodard?
Mr. Chair, I am amenable to an amendment that takes that language out and move the bill forward.
Okay. I think at this time, Representative Mahoney, and then I've got asked Ms. Aves to generate an amendment. We can have that discussion, and maybe some of us will better understand it by the time we get to the floor. If there's a big need, we'll bring it back. Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I prior to amending this kind of language out, I think it would be very wise to at least hear from the department as to why they put the language in.
Is the department here? Okay, Representative Mahoney. Representative Peterson, question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, I'm going to get down to specifics. Is this because of the suit against the department by TESA Academy? Is that why this was put in?
I'm wondering similar types of things, Representative Peterson. From the department, why don't you give us a couple of minutes? If this is going to go on long, we're going to lay this bill over. So welcome to our committee, if you can identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. David Hartman from the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm the acting supervisor in the Charter Schools Center. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, as was pointed out by your colleague, this reinforces the provisions already identified on page 22 that identifies that within our official capacity in the department and an authorizer in the same official capacity still retains responsibility for what we do, and that a school retains their responsibility, a charter school retains their responsibility and liability for all of their actions. This is present in Subdivision 25, and why it's been crosswalked into the line on 11.
Representative.
Is because the charter contract is between two bodies that we don't have, that's a contract between two other organizations that the department is not party to. And this just reinforces that aspect and makes clear that liability is carried forward into that contract between those two other parties. Certainly, if the department acts outside of their official capacity, we may be sued. But this just would reinforce the fact that provision in law in Subdivision 25 carries forward into the contract between those two parties, the charter school and the authorizer.
Representative Peterson, did that give you any answer?
Mr. Chair, it certainly sounds good, but I'm not an attorney, but it seems like it's in there for a purpose. If the department wanted it in, I think I would support it being in, because they obviously have had some experience that says it needs to be there, and so at this point, it sounds good.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I have one question for Mr. Hartman. Does this, I don't practice civil law, but does this have any implications for under a suit for breach of contract, allow, would otherwise, without this language, preclude or allow, actually under the status quo, a charter school to cross-claim under a breach of contract that they may otherwise not be able to currently do in the language in subdivision 25? Does it, would it change that? Or in a suit for breach of contract, could you cross-claim for something under subdivision 25 as it stands? Simon's not here, so I don't, like I said, I don't do civil law, but do you know the answer to that offhand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, no, I don't. Nor I'm not a civil lawyer at all, and I don't have a law degree, so it would be out of my territory to comment on that particular aspect. Certainly, somebody with that level of degree could comment on it if need be.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and that may be the case, and it may be belt suspenders, but regardless, this strikes me as something that came forward with parties agreement within it, and I don't think it's appropriate if you had some kind of peace in the valley, not Pete's in my valley by any means, a stretch of the imagination. I'm going to vote against the bill regardless, but I don't know why we would move it out of here and take an important provision of agreement, maybe the only provision that one side got, out of it to move it forward just because one testifier wanted to have all his cake and eat it too. So I think it should be left in, and if you got to have a debate on the floor or in some other committee about it, Mr. Chair, especially due to the lack of understanding, this bill should not be moved out of this committee without this provision of agreement being in there.
Any further questions? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, prior to removing that particular language, you know, I've said it before, I'm not an attorney. I don't think the testifiers have been attorneys. I would like to kind of figure out from the department's view why that was put in. Some attorney decided that that needed to be in. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm not a huge fan of charter schools. I do know that they have a place. I don't want to kill a bill, but I would, before we take language that was requested by the department, it would be good to hear the legal reasoning on both sides. So, certainly in your preview to hold this bill over and have a hearing on it when we come back, and you know, you're the chair, you get to make that particular decision. But if you pull it out without clear reasoning or clear arguments from both sides, I think we're making a decision without all the information. So I would suggest that we hold it over.
Well, Representative Mahoney, I guess with the department here, Mr. Hartman, I'm telling you, I'm not sure I'm fully understanding why you need this, but I think I'd be okay with moving the bill and the idea that we get a little better understanding of this and the reason it's in there before it comes up on the floor. And Representative Woodard, if you're willing to work with that, maybe that's the way we can go. And maybe it's a lot better understanding, and I don't think we have the time to dissect that right now, and I, at that, it'd be my intention then to move, take a vote on this bill, but Mr. Hartman from the department, we need to have that understanding that we'll get some more clarification before this would move. Representative Wardlow?
Just one more question along these lines, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who could answer this best, but the indemnification and hold harmless language with regard to the commissioner, would that make it impossible for a charter school to sue the commissioner for wrongful termination of a charter school contract or wrongful failure to renew per the provisions on page 21, lines 1 through 11?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative. There are two aspects of termination or non-renewal in subdivision 23. One is between the authorizer and the charter school, and the other is paragraph D in 23, which is the commissioner's ability to terminate the contract. That is laid out and has a process. Both have processes with hearings associated with them, and often lead to lawsuits that follow if folks are unsatisfied with the process. I don't believe that this would prevent that. It hasn't in the past with the current language in subdivision 25. And so I guess my answer to you is no. I don't suspect that it would limit the authority or disallow a charter school from suing for those processes. Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think question is relates to both provisions say you can't sue the commissioner or authorizer, but starting with Representative Hortman offline here, and it strikes me as the difference between indemnification and immunity under subdivision 25 versus indemnification under the proposed language change in the contract relates to attorney's fees, Representative Hortman, or who gets attorney's fees and who gets paid for what if you lose or win or something? What happens there?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman.
It's been a little while since I've been doing civil litigation, but my understanding of indemnification is when you indemnify somebody, you're on the hook for the costs of legal fees that they expend to protect their interests. You're not just paying whatever award is issued against the person, but you're also paying the cost of defense.
So, Mr. Chair, if that's the case, I think this is an important provision because it was obviously a provision that the department wants in there under the contract. It would be a substantial change to have it out, and without really knowing, without the legal expertise on hand to know what it actually does, I think it'd be important to lay this bill over, Mr. Chair, at least until we can get an answer on that, of what actually happens.
Representative Lesh, you read my mind. I think we're going to lay it over. We've got two other bills I think that we can have more clear vision on. At this time, the Chair would propose to lay House File 50, or Senate File 55 as amended on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Woodard, we can make, I think I'd like to get, some of us would like to get some clearer answers on this, and I know we're going into Easter recess, but the Tuesday after we anticipate a meeting, and so if we can talk offline, I'd be happy to visit with you about something that would work with your schedule.
Sure, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll work with Mr. Hartman, too. This is language that the AG's office had, so we'll work with the department to...
And maybe they should be prepared to come and just focus on this a little bit more.
And we'll do that. Thank you,
Very
Mr.
good.
Chair.
Thank you. Members, let's move to Representative... Representative Kelly... House File 1418. No, wait.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
1484. Representative Joskowski moves House File 1484 be recommended to pass. And where's this one got to go, Representative Kelly?
To Education Policy.
Ed Policy. So be passed and we referred to Ed Policy. Please, do you have any amendments, Representative Kelly?
No, I do not.
Why don't you give us a quick presentation, particularly to the issues that are in front of our committee. You may proceed. Do you have other witnesses?
I have Ms. Linda Sandvig.
What's that?
Today. Ms. Linda Sandvig with me today.
Okay, very good. Brevity's the name. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1484 makes several changes to the Adult Basic Education Performance Tracking System. It will improve the Adult Basic Education capacity to comply with required federal reporting, improve programming, and conduct longitudinal studies. The tracking system was initially put in place in 2000 to comply with federal law, and to serve as a mechanism to assure effectiveness of the ABE programs. This bill makes several modifications to improve our ability at both state and local levels to evaluate the effectiveness of ABE programming and obtain information from the effectiveness regarding the effectiveness of ABE's collaborations with partner agencies and human services, higher education, and workforce development. And I'll let Ms. Sandvig explain part of the what she'd like to talk about on behalf of the Literacy Action Network.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here on behalf of the Literacy Action Network, which is an organization that represents adult basic education providers. We have 51 consortiums throughout the state that deliver ABE services. That's GEDs, diplomas, that's workforce, ESL services, citizenship, and workforce development. What we're looking to do in this bill is it's already in law as far as the tracking system. What we're trying to do is add some components as far as a follow-up. One is looking at some of the public assistance programs. 42% of people on MFIP do not have either a GED or a high school diploma. So we're looking as far as tracking individuals with that. Probably what also looking at them when we track that as far as data match, we would have to look at doing the data match with the Department of Human Services, which has not been included. And also the other issue is we found in tracking with higher ed, if we don't go through the Office of Higher Education, that we can't track as far as students going into private secondary institutions. So a lot of our focus is on return of on investment. What I would just kind of point out as far as I think what's interest to this committee is that on line 2.9 goes through kind of the process, because we do the data tracking through Social Security numbers. This is only if we go through as far as if you look at what's in law with the Tennyson warning, that they have to be notified in writing and it has to be easily understood to the student. We have to provide the specific reasons for why we are tracking that information and let them know that if they provide that, that they do not have to provide the Social Security number, and also that there's no adverse reaction to that, and that it's for the effectiveness that's described in the earlier paragraph adding the new provisions.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Mahoney? And then is there anybody here that's came specifically to testify for or against this bill? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, my question is, in terms of the tracking, this is actually in concerns with the workforce. How long are you expecting to track ABE participants? Are you 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years out? Because there's a whole movement to stack adult basic ed onto the community college, and from the community college onto the four-year. So if you could just kind of lay out how long. I know that's not part of the civil law stuff, but I'm just trying to figure this out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's a good question. I don't know specifically, but we have added in this language longitudinal. So the idea is to be looking at going for a longer period and looking at different stops that they would go through too, so that if you're looking at basically getting their GED and then going on from that as far as workforce, and if they're going on to secondary too. So it is looking at a long term. I don't have specific time frame.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Mahoney.
It's a big issue for jobs and economic development. I don't want to see this bill in that particular committee, and I don't think the author wants to go there. So I'm sure Ms. Sandvik will talk to me about where that's going. I've been involved with ABE before, so I'd like to know so that I could pass it along to the to Chair Gunther.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, I will get back to you on that.
Thank you. Any other discussion, members? Having none, all those in favor, the Chair will renew Representative Druskowski's motion to pass House File 1484 and refer it to the Education Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. What's the next one? House File. 472. You doing it, Draz, or Scott? Representative Scott is going to assist Representative Smith, who couldn't make it this morning. House Representative Scott moves House File 473, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary, I believe. Representative Scott, do you know?
I'm not sure. I'm pinch-hitting for Representative Smith, but Mr. Reynolds is nodding and said yes to go to Judiciary.
Refer it to Judiciary. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr.
Down
Chair.
To 10 minutes before caucuses, I think, start, so
okay.
Hopefully we can do it.
Well, this bill appears to be pretty simple in nature. They're just asking that the child support would be the child support amount would be determined prior to determining the amount for spousal maintenance. And I do have a testifier here.
Mr. Kennedy,
I believe, is here to help.
Mr. Testify. Kennedy, why don't you come forward?
He's already here.
Please identify yourself for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Westrum and members. My name is Bruce Kennedy. I'm a divorce lawyer from Roseville, and I serve as the legislative chair for the family law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And Representative Smith was instrumental in changing the child support guidelines in Minnesota. It went into effect in 2007. I think they've worked fairly well. We do have one little tweak that we think would make things go more efficiently and make our negotiations smoother and not have to spend a lot of time doing trial and error, and that is calculating the amount of child support first and then leaving us to calculate the amount of maintenance after support is already determined. Because if you have spousal maintenance is one of the more difficult areas to negotiate. We often go back and forth on that one. And if every time we change the amount of spousal maintenance that we are proposing, we have to recalculate the support, it just makes the negotiations go on and on and on. We're not trying to change the bottom line of how much each person is paying. We just want to change the process and make it more efficient and make the negotiations smoother and save us all some trouble.
Very well. Representative Scott, I understand there's an A1 amendment. Mr. Kennedy, are you familiar with that amendment? The chair will move the A1.
Chair Westrum, I am familiar with it. My fault when I was going through the statute to make the changes. I made the change at the beginning of the statute, but there was another reference to the same provision at the end of the statute, so that should be corrected as well. It's just the same thing in a lower place in the statute.
That's what the A1 amendment is. The chair will move the A1 amendment to modify House File 473. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Any questions? Is there anybody in the audience that came specifically to testify for or against this bill? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kennedy, what are the thresholds at which spousal maintenance is actually awarded in terms of either income disparity between the spouses or length of time married? And what percentage of dissolutions in Minnesota are awarded any kind of spousal maintenance?
Mr. Kennedy?
Chair Westrum and Representative Lesh, I don't know the exact numbers. The number of cases that have spousal maintenance are pretty small. Most divorces do not involve spousal maintenance. The ones that do have spousal maintenance are highly contentious because there is no formula for spousal maintenance. The statute is 518.552, and it is a series of factors for the court to consider. There is some direction given in the statute as far as what the court should look at in terms of the amount and the length of the maintenance, but it is the opposite of formulaic, and I don't know. I can't really help you with that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh,
I'm trying to figure out who we're helping, because if the percentage of spousal maintenance was very low, which was my understanding, are we talking about some captain of industry that, you know, marries high school sweetheart, she stays home and takes care of the garden and whatever, and in order to hide income, offshores various manufacturing concerns or something, and well, at least now it'll be calculated after child support, so that's taken into consideration. That's why I asked, because I don't know the set of individuals who were either helping or impacting. That's all. The reason I was asking.
Mr. Kennedy, any further insight on that?
Chair Westrum, Representative Lesh. It's a small percentage of people. It is usually where there's a significant disparity of income. It might be a situation where one spouse has stayed home with the children for a few years and will take some time to get back into the workplace. That would be the typical situation where there's children involved. But usually, it's an advantage here. If we can calculate child support first, then we can immediately see whether or not spousal maintenance should even be looked at. And so it just makes things simpler.
Very good. Any further questions? Having none, and we have no further testifiers, we did move the A. We did adopt the A1 amendment. So no further questions. Caucus is looming. Representative Scott renews her motion to pass House File 473 as amended and refer it to Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Meeting is adjourned. We'll see you after Easter.